Book University Divinity School, and we hope that you'll make plans to come to each and every community breakfast. In a country crying out for transformative religious leadership, I can think of no one more equipped to help us consider religion and politics in the 2008 election. Our speaker this morning spends his time helping to develop just such leadership. The Ann Potter Wilson Distinguished Professor in American Religious History, the author most recently of In Pursuit of the Almighty's Dollar, we welcome this morning Dean James Hudnut Boynton.
Good morning and welcome again to the Divinity School and to the first of our community breakfasts. It's good to see so many of you out for our first one. We even have some visitors from Chicago here. You can tell them because they've got the I voted symbols on. You'll get that later, it's early. Is 2008 the year of the religious president, like some other years? Or will it be a quiet year? Doubtful. Who would have thought that this would be the year when candidates for the office of president from both parties would be repeatedly asked about their faith, their church affiliations, and their prayer life from leading members of the secular media? Chris Matthews asking, "Do you pray? What do you pray for?" The Democratic Party, after being mostly tone deaf about religion, has finally got religion. Meanwhile, the Republican Party remains eager to maintain its lock on highly religious voters while its candidates present a rather motley crew of religious backgrounds, former positions on abortion, and more divorces than a daytime soap opera. What gives? How important is a president's faith? Well, let's take a brief and selective step back into history for an answer to that question. In his farewell address, the first president advised his fellow citizens that religion and morality were the great pillars of human happiness, these firmest props of the duties of men and citizens. National morality, Washington added, could not exist in exclusion of religious principle. Virtue or morality, he concluded, as the products of religion, were a necessary spring of popular government. So from the beginning, there is no religious test for office in our Constitution, but we expect our presidents to be faith-friendly, or faith-literate, or at least be able to sidestep the issue effectively. Let's go to Thomas Jefferson, then. Thomas Jefferson gave us a wall of separation as an enduring metaphor as to how religion and the state ought to relate. But he himself did not hesitate to play on both sides of that wall personally, as can be seen from the so-called Jefferson Bible. Jefferson, during his time in the White House and then for 20 years afterwards, worked on a project of cutting up two Bibles to make his own Bible, the real Bible, consisting just of the teachings and morals of Jesus of Nazareth. No resurrection, no miracles. This is the president spending his time in the White House thinking about religion. Then we go to Abraham Lincoln. In his short second inaugural address, Lincoln placed the entire Civil War in a theological conflict framework. And I quote from Lincoln's second inaugural. "Neither party expected for the war the magnitude or the duration which it has already attained." both read the same Bible and pray to the same God. And each invokes his aid against the other. It may seem strange that any man should dare to ask a just God's assistance in wringing their bread from the sweat of other men's faces. That's Lincoln's slam on slavery. But let us judge not that we be not judged. The Almighty has his own purposes. Woe unto the world, and Lincoln is quoting from Scripture, woe unto the world because of offenses, for it must needs be that offenses come. But woe to that man by whom the offense cometh. If we shall suppose, still Lincoln, that American slavery is one of those offenses which, in the providence of God, must need come, but which, having continued through his appointed time, he now wills to remove, and that he gives to both North and South this terrible war as the woe due to those by whom the offense came, shall we discern therein any departure from those divine attributes which the believers in a living God always ascribe to him? You can get a PhD in this building for less profound thoughts. Lincoln was a remarkable theologian, you know, saying both sides have something to lose in this. And have lost something in the eyes of God, in the providence of God. Well, let's go on to another popular Republican president. Reagan, you may recall, canceled his scheduled State of the Union speech. Upon good advice and with good instincts, the night that the Challenger blew up, and acted instead during that time as a kind of pastor in chief when he addressed the nation the night of the explosion, saying, "The crew of the space shuttle Challenger honored us by the manner in which they lived their lives. We will never forget them, nor the last time we saw them this morning, as they prepared for their journey and waved goodbye, and then they slipped the surly bounds of earth to touch the face of God." Reagan had a gift, as many good pastors and priests and rabbis do, of knowing when to end with poetry rather than a flat declaration of fact. More recently, Bill Clinton addressed the Oklahoma Bombing Memorial Prayer Service. In April 1995 in Oklahoma City, Clinton upstaged a priest, a rabbi, and a minister, a couple ministers actually, by knowing how and when to use the Bible to utter a word of comfort. See, the religious leaders were all trying to avoid saying the word God, and were talking about evil and the incomprehensibility of evil. And Clinton quoted Scripture three times and said, among other things, this: "To all my fellow Americans beyond this hall, I say one thing we owe those who have sacrificed is the duty to purge ourselves of the dark forces which gave rise to this evil. They are forces that threaten our common peace, our freedom, our way of life. Let us teach our children that the God of comfort is also the God of righteousness. Those who trouble their own house will inherit the wind. Justice will prevail." My fellow Americans, Clinton concluded, a tree takes a long time to grow, and wounds take a long time to heal. But we must begin. Those who are lost now belong to God. Someday, we will be with them. But until that happens, their legacy must be our lives. Thank you all, and God bless you. If Clinton's presidency had ended right at that moment, he would be remembered very differently by the entirety of the polis. Let's go on to George W. Bush, Clinton's successor. During the first set of debates, he was asked a question: who is your favorite philosopher? And he said, Jesus Christ is my favorite philosopher. Initially the secular media scoffed, but the voters dug it. Bush is also a religious president, has used conceptions of religion, but far differently than a Washington or a Lincoln or even a Clinton. He operates largely out of the theopoetics of good and evil. There are websites that you can go to see all the evil statements. I just chose one from September of 2001. Make no mistake about it, this is good versus evil. These are evildoers. They have no justification for their actions. There's no religious justification. There's no political justification. The only motivation is evil. Let's go to the next slide. You may have noticed that I skipped over Kennedy. That is because Kennedy is highly relevant to the religious issue when it comes to a candidate's electability. And that's a central issue for the 2008 election. To get elected, John F. Kennedy had to go to the heart of Dixie and make a promise of secularity. In his address to the Greater Houston Ministerial Association, and, you know, this, for some of you who are younger, this seems like way back when, but this is the playbook out of which John Kerry operated, out of that Mitt Romney's trying to use. He said the following words: I believe in an America where the separation of church and state is absolute, where no Catholic prelate would tell the president, should he be Catholic, how to act, and no Protestant minister would tell his parishioners for whom to vote, where no church or church school is granted any public funds or political preference, and where no man is denied political office merely because his religion differs from the president who might appoint him or the people who might elect him. George W. Bush's second opponent was remarkably literate about religion. Go to Kerry. The third presidential debate of the 2004 elections saw John Kerry invoking John F. Kennedy and James 2:17 as his models for relating his faith to his work as a politician. He said, and as President Kennedy said, and of course this is a problem with Kerry, he never spoke in his own voice like Kennedy did, right? He had to say, as President Kennedy said when he ran for president, he said, I'm not running to be a Catholic president, I'm running to be a president who happens to be Catholic. And then by inference, me too. My faith affects everything I do, in truth. There's a great passage of the Bible that says, what does it mean, my brother, to say you have faith if there are no deeds? Faith without works is dead. He continues, I think that everything you do in public life has to be guided by your faith, affected by your faith, but without transferring it in any official way to other people. But I know this, that President Kennedy, in his inaugural address, told all of us that here on earth, God's work must truly be our own. And that's what we have to do. I think that's the best test of public service. But times had changed. Catholics wanted to know why he drew the line at doing God's work at abortion. And Protestants have been schooled, conservative Protestants have been schooled through odd lines by Luther to think that James was a gospel of straw, and that Catholics continue to practice works righteousness. Carey's religious response was thoughtful, learned, nuanced, and sincere. And of course, as such, it fell flat. So John Carey serves as an important object lesson. Since Lincoln, the best theologian, doesn't get elected. Rarely gets elected. Therefore, in 2008, we have an officially secular country whose citizens still expect their presidents to be religious in a good way, and without offending them, the citizens, on issues that they care about. Of course, they care about different things. I'm going to briefly now introduce the candidates and then to argue that whether religion is a big issue this year or not is finally a result of which candidates are matched up after Iowa and New Hampshire, or is it Florida and Michigan? So, here then are this year's cast of characters. Let's start with the spice, the candidates who make the race interesting, but who won't be around next year at this time. Duncan Hunter is a Southern Baptist and a Christian Zionist, advocate for Israel. Ron Paul was raised in a devout Lutheran family. He even thought about becoming a pastor. Just imagine that. But he ended up a Texas Baptist, and like Howard Dean, he doesn't like to talk about it. Tom Tancredo started out Roman Catholic until 20 years ago, when a hole in my soul led him to become an evangelical Presbyterian. He's very faithful in a suburban evangelical sort of way, but his faith concerns do not extend to immigrants. None of these three are getting any traction. Next come the Democrats' low-hanging fruit. Let's start with Dennis Kucinich, a Catholic from Cleveland. The spice he brings to the race is that he opposed the war in Iraq for moral and religious reasons from the very start. He doesn't need money or pride to stay in the race, so expect him to serve as the conscience of the party on the morality of the war right down until the convention. Mike Gravel is a Unitarian who is really remarkable on equality issues, but looks to establishment and sounds to establishment to connect with younger voters who might actually like what Grandpa stands for. Joe Biden and Chris Dodd are Catholic, but as senators who are too used to saying whatever pops into their heads without immediate repercussions, they're non-starters in this race. Two signs of their low status, and the fact that no one knows that Chris Dodd is married to a Mormon and raising his children, two signs are that nobody knows that Chris Dodd is a Mormon and is raising his children in that faith. And meanwhile, the Catholic bishops aren't even bothering to mobilize against their three pro-choice Catholics. Now let's look at the three truly interesting longer shot Republicans. These are the three who finished 1, 2, and 3 in the Iowa straw poll. Mitt Romney is smooth, married to his first wife, and doesn't just talk family values. Indeed, his family is larger than a lot of micro voting blocks that Hillary Clinton's pollsters are counting on to win the race. Being Mormon is a big issue with the Republican base in the Southeast, however. Winning in Iowa or New Hampshire isn't the same thing as winning in Georgia, and nobody gets to be president in the Republican side without winning Georgia and Texas and so on. Then there's Mike Huckabee. Never count out
a boy born in Hope, Arkansas. Mike Huckabee doesn't just sound like a preacher, he is one. And words flow off his tongue, not unlike the Democrats' John Edwards. Indeed, I'll say later, the matchups matter. If it was Edwards versus Huckabee, we would have one heck of a revival meeting for an election. The effect, though, of his rhetoric filled with morality, salvation, and values talk is to make the other candidates try to sound like him. The longer he stays, the more the Republican side sounds like that revival. And finally, Sam Brownback will finish in the back of the pack and probably cut and run pretty soon. But as a recent and very serious convert to Catholicism, he will keep abortion and the culture of life issues in front of the party as long as he stays in. His true significance, however, will be felt behind the scenes in two secretive Washington groups, the Fellowship and the Values Action Team. If any of these three emerge as front runners, then I urge you to look online at their Iowa straw poll speeches to see how religious and heated campaign rhetoric might be next fall. Next slide. Bill Richardson is somebody everybody likes in the Democratic Party for vice president. He's Latino, Catholic, Ivy League credentials and executive office, even foreign policy skills. But he's not going to be a presidential front runner. And I'd like to have to eat those words next year, but I don't think so. So let's go to the three front runners in the Democratic Party, who all, interestingly enough, have conventional, mainline Protestant associations. They all have visible first spouses in their campaigns, moderate positions on issues, and apart from race, gender, and working class upbringings in the case of the men, they resemble old-fashioned cloth-coat Republicans of the 1950s. Each can talk about their views and practice of prayer intelligently and without scaring off important secular or non-Christian Democratic base voters. We know what churches they go to, and they can each talk about how faith informs their liberal politics. These candidates and the candidacies are, in short, heavily influenced by the model of Bill Clinton. None of them, not Clinton, not Obama, not Edwards, can talk, however, about how their faith helps them know what to do about the war in Iraq. Big liability there. Finally, we turn to the three leading Republicans besides Romney. John McCain exemplifies the best in a kind of loyal West Point man, and even belongs to an establishment church with red, white, and blue colors, the Episcopal Church. His fundraising may be mortally wounded, but if Rudy or Fred falter, he'll start looking good next to Obama, Clinton, and Edwards. Rudolph Giuliani appeals to security voters, but there are chinks in the armor of this night. It remains to be seen if he can explain his way out of his marital and pro-choice records enough to keep going. And finally, we have Fred Thompson, who only goes to church when he's with his mother. Brentwood Church of Christ down in Franklin. Thomas sounds off about values, but he does not want to get too specific about why they are his values. Now let's turn away from who is running to who is voting and what their issues might be. This part also has a history, which I can tell in a lot less words. In the 1960s, sociologists and political scientists knew about the religious factor. And Gerhard Lenski is sort of the name, along with Milton Yinger, on this issue. They knew, looking at several elections going back through the early 20th century, that Catholics voted Democratic and Protestants voted Republican. But the more they tried to use that, they discovered that their analysis really didn't have predictive power. So they began to turn to regional analysis and class analysis instead. With the 2000 election and the intensive reanalysis of post-poll polling data, you know, people asking exit polls, if you will, what people were, how they voted, how it affected, there was a discovery of a new religious voter. Evangelicals, but more importantly, people who went to church at least once a week voted for George Bush, and those who never went to church voted for Al Gore. This made sociologists think they, you know, found the philosopher's stone, and they worked it on the 2004 election, where it held up somewhat, but began to leak as some religious voters defected to Kerry, and a lot of people who seemed to be much more securely in the Republican base also split out, particularly when it came to state and local elections. Now, let's see. Let's go back to the pie wedge, if you will. Okay, let's then go forward, if you don't mind. Wow, is there a... there's no pie wedge on there. Okay, boy, that's going to... Go back to wedge issues then. You'll have to catch this on MPT, where I think we've got the right slide. There's a slide, if you will, that has pie wedges. And it shows that there are... And this is from the analysis of Mike Waldman and Steve Waldman and John Green, who determined that the problem with that religious factor thing is there isn't just one religious factor. There are almost tribes. They call them the 12 tribes of American voters. There's the religious right. There's the religious left, which incidentally are about the same size. About 16% each. There are white-bred Protestants, about 9%. The interesting thing about these tribes is that the people from these tribes and their preferences can be split between parties. So George H.W. Bush and John Edwards are both white-bred Protestants. Okay? And who gets elected... And what that preference group might go for depends who they like. You see, these 12 preference groups come down to having just two choices. And they will shade off, and you can predict where the religious right will go and where the religious left will go, but you can't predict where the white-bred Protestants will go. You can't predict where the Latino and Latina vote will go. You can't predict until you know who the candidates are. And then, knowing who the candidates are and what the preferences are and who the group that is most, there's a group called convertible Catholics, who could go either way. And it depends on where the candidates are on issues that matter to these groups. The thing about the group analysis is, as you go more deeply into it, and because I didn't bring the slide, I urge you to Google the 12 tribes of American politics. Go to it and Look how the preferences and concerns go much deeper than what we think of as the religious issues. In fact, in the 2004 election, nobody would have seen war as a religious issue. It certainly is now in some of these subgroups. It is for the white bread Protestants, it is for the convertible Catholics, it certainly is for black and Latino groups, voting blocks. The wedge issues and how we end up finding out whether we're going to have all kinds of fights about abortion or war or stem cell research or faith in the public schools or gay marriage versus marriage equality, even the way we talk about it will be different, depends on who's running. If it should happen that a candidate is weak in one area, subject to you know, all kinds of debate. Let's say it's Rudolph Giuliani versus John Edwards. Abortion is just not going to be a very big issue in the election. The appointment of judges that will, you know, repeal Roe v. Wade, it's not going to be an issue. Other matchups, it well could be. Just like in the 1992 election, marriage was off the table because there were all kinds of rumors about George H.W. Bush having a girlfriend on the side. So nobody was going to go after that. And Bill Clinton didn't have to face in the general election potentially his most embarrassing and diverting issue. So, you know, this is not predictive in the sense that I can tell you which of these issues are going to be the big issues in 2008. What I can tell you is watch who the candidates are, watch who they appeal to, watch the 12 tribes, and then you might see what they're going to throw mud about. And I do mean throw mud. Let's go to the... my analysis here is that the wedge issues are often not the issues that really matter to the candidates. They're the issues that matter enough to the voters as symbols of the voters' own status, whether they feel okay in the world, in the polis, whether things are moving, you know, in that, I think it's University of Michigan poll, are things moving in the right direction or the wrong direction? And therefore, the use of simple wedge issue positions to determine whether we think we've got the right person will emerge. So way back World War I, we had "Will you back me or back booze?" You know, it's the troops versus the wets. Vote yes for prohibition, November 5th. This is the Ohio Dry Federation using, campaign negative advertising way back when. Okay, next one. As I've said, the matchups will dictate the issues. I've told you who the candidates are and what the wedge issues are. Finally, whether we get a great religious president or a quiet Ford, Eisenhower, or FDR kind of religious presidency, or a religious chump president, you know, who uses wields religion negatively, depends on the matchup. Is it Lincoln, Douglas, or is it Bush v. Gore? What's gained and what's lost in all of this religion and politics exchange that will is unfolding and will unfold in the next year in front of us? Well, this starts with the question of whether we really want a religious president. That is somebody who does religion a lot in public office. If yes, then one gain can be a certain amount of moral literacy about what the right thing to do might be, and a way of talking about policy in relation to the events and issues that actually come up. George H.W. Bush, you may be interested to know, or may even remember, in the first Iraq, or the first Gulf War, decided not to go any further on the basis of just war principles that he'd learned in his Episcopal upbringing, that he'd learned in his Yale days, that he'd learned in his Army Air Corps days, that he'd practiced around the CIA. He was literate about that, and we didn't know. In fact, there is a great moment where he debated the presiding bishop of the Episcopal Church, Edmund Browning at the time, in the White House intensely about the morality of going in at all. And, in an intellectual war of words and wit, Bush was right on his account of the issues, and Browning was muddled in his thinking, even though there was a better case to be made even against that war, as war in general, but Browning didn't make it. So, but there are losses as well. Loss is a judicious selection of issues. Stem cell research, yeah, it may be important, but how does that really figure? Is that a way to avoid health care for the uninsured? You know, a health care quality of life, culture of life issue that really affects many, many more people. Doing the right thing about something for a few rather than for the many seems to be what we often get when wedge issues, and particularly wedge morality issues, emerge. Lost also can be a respect for diversity. You're on my bus, or you're evil kind of attitude. Or a loss of principled difference. I'm not going to force anybody to do this, but this is how I feel. We don't like our presidents to sound that way. We force them to greater certainty in the course of electoral politics than we would be prudent in leadership. When the matchups determine positions on wedge issues, we don't find out in time about the core issues. Wedge issues, religious issues, tend to have a way of masking what kind of person our presidents really will be, even religiously and morally. Candidates won't handle hypotheticals, and they'll avoid creating new strong positions. For instance, Iraq in the 2000 debates was nowhere to be seen. Gore came out of an administration where they'd been dealing with Saddam for 8 years. Bush's inner circle clearly had strong feelings left over from 1991, 1992. We learned that later. None of that was displayed before us. And I want to give the last word to John F. Kennedy, who in that famous talk before the Houston Ministerial Association addressed the religious issue and then said this: "While the so-called religious issue is necessarily and properly the chief topic here tonight, I want to emphasize from the outset that I believe we have far more critical issues in the 1960 campaign. The spread of communist influence until it now festers only 90 miles from the coast of Florida, the humiliating treatment of our president and vice president by those who no longer respect our power, The hungry children I saw in West Virginia, the old people who cannot pay their doctor bills, the families forced to give up their farms, an America with too many slums and too few schools, and too late to the moon and outer space. These are the real issues which should decide this campaign, and they are not religious issues. For war and hunger and ignorance and despair, no religious barrier. I would hope that we'd get somebody to say that this year, but I don't think we will. But I would add this. No truly religious person can pretend or practice indifference to war, hunger, ignorance, or despair. And it's time we made those the issues that our candidates addressed. Thank you. I would be happy to take a few questions if we have some in the audience.
I'd love to hear your comment on Barack Obama's ties to Jeremiah Wright and Trinity UCC. Just to expand that a little more, it's not quite like Hillary and John in that point.
Well, yeah. There's this terrible irony for Barack Obama, which is all these. The early question was, is he black enough? And anybody who knew Jeremiah Wright and Trinity UCC Church, south side of Chicago, would say, "Man, no, he's hanging with a truly Afrocentric and liberationist, dynamic, prophetic preacher." And anybody who's heard Obama talk about that relationship knows that this is something that counts to him. Okay, he's very articulate about that relationship. But the problem is, that kind of church scares some of the very people he wants to attract in Iowa and New Hampshire and what have you. So it's very complicated by race and the racial suspicions. If they showed a lot of general election voters what goes on in one of Jeremiah Wright's sermons, he might be called to, do you agree with this? And if he says no, he might not advance. But you know, this is shaping Obama's soul, and gives me some real hope if he advances. How he dances around that will be a kind of remarkable sort of dance, and the matchup will matter as to whether, you know, if somebody comes from a semi-offensive religious background like Mitt Romney, religion's off the table like Girlfriends on the Side was in 92. Yes?
Who do you think gets to choose the issues that we hear about? The candidates or the media or the voters?
Well, you know, the news cycle helps get things going in ways that it just didn't, you know. If you think back to Kennedy and Nixon in 1960, they went on about,
Moy and
Matsu, you know, in the Taiwan Straits, for 20 minutes or more. You just wouldn't have that happen anymore, in part because journalists have been injected into the journalists and well-staged questions and quick answers have been injected into the debates. There's lots of opportunities for the kind of gaffes like, well, Poland's a free country, you know, thing that Ford did. And from Ford forward, the opportunity to step into a wedge issue, kind of like a cow pie in a pasture, has really taken over. So who chooses the issues? It's the non-sure-footed candidate and then the piling on effect. You know, electoral politics are not in real healthy shape. Some candidates who stick to message can overcome it. Bill Clinton, you know, people who play by the rules and work hard ought to emerge. He stuck to it. He didn't get distracted. It worked for him. John Edwards tried the same thing and it didn't.
Yeah. One president you did mention was Carter. Where did you put Carter in all this?
You know, Carter is a very religious, morally concerned about what the right thing is to do, policy wonk sort of guy. But he's, you know, in the end, the Scholes and Jeremiah, it's, you know, the sweater in the white, the Oval Office, and telling us to turn down the thermostats. Though, of course, you know, we celebrate Al Gore for telling us the same thing now. Just fell on deaf ears. The fact that we admire him so much in retirement for Habitat, for continued human rights work, for free elections, just shows that sometimes electoral politics and even the soundbite politics of what it takes to move people on policy is a thing that even a person of good and sterling character can't get around. Now, the other thing to remember, and I think the thing that may make a difference for 2008, is that in the presidential term that comes after 2008, is that Carter, like Ford, had he won, had a terrible hand. Right, he had hostages in Iran that would have happened probably anyway, because Ford would have accepted the Shah. He also would have had inflation. He would have had the disaster, national malaise of the war in Vietnam. And we're headed into a period in which whoever is president is going to have the mess that George W. Bush and his administration managed to give off to these characters. So Obama, Clinton, Edwards, Therian, they've got a war to get out of, and a war that can't be gotten out of without seeming like a bad leader. There is no good solution, and Republican or Democrat, it's going to look like a mess. So, do you want to win that or not? The whole thing about why all these guys are running, it's just they've been running all their lives, and it's the roaches want to be mice, the mice want to be rats, the rats want to be cats.
George Lakoff has a book about linguistics and how if you frame the debate in the correct way, anyone who disagrees is automatically un-American. I'm skipping over a lot. Do you think that has much influence, and how does that relate to religion?
Well, let's take evil. Evil is just this smackdown. And if you've been saying evil from 2001 to 2004, if John Kerry, particularly given his linguistic capabilities, even he's talking about his own faith, and he stops at this transcript has commas, ellipses. They don't know how to punctuate it. And evil against nuance just is not a character. Now, senators run against longtime senators. We're going to get a lot of nuance, and we're going to get Matsu and Kamoy again. And then who shows up at the polls will be fairly small, but I don't think that's going to happen. So watch for the evil of 2008.
Let's then head up 1 minute.